Programming is supported by Topline Construction Firm, your local women-owned roofing contractor based out of Shoreview, Minnesota. Roof replacement, both retail and insurance work. More information at toplineconstructionfirm.com.
First, a conversation about creativity, and I think it's both practical and philosophical. Elizabeth Gilbert's newest book, Big Magic, Creative Living Beyond Fear, comes out in paperback next week. So we're going to listen back to a conversation with her when we went in depth on why creativity demands courage. I would guess that Elizabeth Gilbert ran across this Yeats quote when she was writing her book on creativity. It goes like this. The world is full of magic things potentially waiting for our senses to grow sharper. Seems to fit with her belief that ideas swim around on the hunt for the receptive imagination. She writes, when an idea thinks it has found somebody, say you, who might be able to bring it into the world, the idea will pay you a visit. It will try to get your attention. Mostly, you will not notice. Elizabeth Gilbert is the author of a number of books, including The Signature of All Things, a wonderful novel, and Eat, Pray, Love. Her new book is titled Big Magic, Creative Living Beyond Fear. And she's with us today from New York. Welcome back. It's good to talk to you again.
Thank you. It's a delight to be here, Carrie.
Is every idea, Liz, that's swirling out there so democratic? Aren't there creative ideas that really can only be brought to fruition because somebody has lived a certain life experience?
I don't know, to tell you the truth. And that's why I'm very comfortable calling this thing a mystery, because there's so much about it that we do not know. I'm hesitant to jump on that idea because I feel like if we jump on that idea, then we're automatically sort of giving ourselves and other people excuses not to engage with creativity, right? We're saying like, well, this is really something that only very special people can do, or this is only something that people with a certain kind of training and background and access to certain sort of contacts and studio space can do. This is only something you can do if you've got this degree of natural talent. And I think there's enough of that going around already that people tend to think that way, that I don't want to get behind any line of thinking that encourages this sense that creativity only belongs to the special, the privileged, the tormented, and the trained, rather than this sense that this is our shared human inheritance and that the entire history of the world has been altered by human beings getting really weird ideas, making things that no one asks them to do, creating stuff for no rational reason, throwing it out there in the world and seeing what happens. And my concern is more about including as many people in that conversation as possible rather than limiting it.
Yeah, I guess you're trying to blow up the idea of creative elitism. I wonder how we got there.
Yeah, it's a very good question. And yes, I am trying to blow it up. You know, I have theories about how we got there. I think some of it is the general move in the last 100 years in Western society toward greater and greater specialization in all fields, which in some ways is incredibly efficient. And it means that, you know, that people are doing what they're very, very best at and that you're only studying one tiny little piece of the puzzle. It's a way to be incredibly productive in an industrial model. Mm-hmm. And even in an academic model, it's kind of terrifically efficient to give everybody one tiny little piece of skill set. The problem with that is that very soon when you start shunting people into those specializations, everybody else gets sort of left out. And I think one thing that happens in schools especially is that usually around the age of 8 or 9, the school system starts to notice which one of these kids are actually quote-unquote talented.
Yeah, that's right.
And those kids get separated from the rest of the herd. And two things happen in that. One is that the other kids, the 98% who do not get identified as talented, get this message that creativity is not for them. You know, Heather's the one who can sing. Max is the one who's a good artist, you know, not you. And then you stop creating sort of for the rest of your life. And the other thing is we put an awful lot of pressure on Heather and Max. You know, suddenly there's only two kids in the whole school who are considered creative and they have to carry the hopes and dreams of the entire society on their thin and often neurotic shoulders, right? And so I feel like we sort of do a disservice to everyone when we create that sort of elitist specialization of the arts.
Do you think, as you're describing what happens in education, I'm thinking, I feel like there is more acceptance today of non-traditional creativity, that there's a lot of arenas and places in which to experiment with your creativity. Now, are you going to have a huge audience for that? You know, maybe not. Maybe you're never going to reach Elizabeth Gilbert kind of heights for the creative things that you do. But there's a lot of places to be expressive around that, aren't there?
Yeah, I would say in a way more than ever. You know, certainly the internet has provided an arena in which anybody who wants to put a fingerprint on the world can do so. Yeah. And I know that there are people, I've spoken to people who are really disturbed by that and who find things like self-publishing to be, I think, kind of repugnant to them because they say this is dumbing down the literary world. These books are not very well edited. You know, it's making everybody sort of stupider and sloppier. Somebody even said to me the other day, aren't you worried that your book is just going to encourage a lot of bad artists to make bad art? But the fact that you would even say that just points to what a jerk you are, one. And two, no, that is not my concern. My concern is totally the opposite. My concern are the millions of people who have been somehow given a message that the what I consider to be the fundamental definition of a human experience, which is that we are the creative ape, right? That somehow those people have been told that they are not allowed to participate in the story of creation. That's what I get upset about. But I'm just a big fat populist, so I can't really help it.
You know, you describe ideas as independent, quote, disembodied, energetic life forms. And so, you know, I got a little literal with this, Elizabeth. So I started thinking, what happens when that independent, energetic life form hits writers as different as James Baldwin, James McBride, Salman Rushdie? I mean, is it an idea that then writers like that with different life experience bring their own interpretation to? I really want to understand how you think about this.
Well, the reason I describe it that way, and I do put a really mystical description on it, and I fully acknowledge, I have a sort of warning in the beginning of the book, like, we are going to go kind of Hogwarts here. You know, like, there is the word magic in the title of this book for a reason. You know, like, we are suspending rational thought as we're talking about the creative process. The reason I describe it that way is, frankly, Carrie, because that's what it feels like. That's what it feels like when an idea comes to you. It does feel like a visitation. And even people who are deeply empirical and terribly rational and very linear in their thinking, when they talk about the moment when they had an idea, they'll even use that language. They'll say, and then this idea came to me, right? It's a thing we say. An idea came, because that's what it feels like. It feels like something has been brought to you. And in my experience with it, having worked with that strange energy for decades, is that oftentimes I feel like I am visited by ideas that are better for Salman Rushdie than they are for me. You know, that I feel like there is a sort of democratic visitation in these ideas, that they're constantly coming to you, and that your job as a creator is to sort of sift through them. And the way that I deal with it when I get an idea that is interesting but feels to me very obviously not for me, I just feel like they kind of go around knocking on people's heads and shoulders and saying, are you my mother? Are you my mother? Are you my mother? They're just looking for a collaborator, right? So when an idea comes to me and it's not for me, my reaction to it is to sort of speak to it in a very unapologetically real way and just say, I'm honored by your visitation, but you know, you should probably go visit Barbara Kingsolver's house because I think this is really more for her. And I always try to be very polite because I don't want, I don't want word getting around the universe that I'm hard to work with or that I'm a diva. You know, I have – my mom raised me to have good manners. So, I even speak to inspiration in the most polite way. And then I say, you know, send me another one. Let's try another one. Is it this one? Is it this one? And I feel like that is maybe the only place in our lives where it is completely safe to have that kind of completely irrational thinking. You know, we don't want it on our school boards, and we don't want it in scientific realms, and we don't want it in political realms. But in creative realms, it's okay to kind of keep one corner of your mind open for mystery, mysticism, magic, and things that absolutely make no sense, because the creative process itself often makes no sense.
You make me think of an interview that I did, and this is years ago, when Edna O'Brien, I think she has a memoir out now, but
yes, but yeah,
the last
memoir.
Novel, yeah. So when she was touring for the last novel, and she did Talking Volumes with us, and she had the most specific description of making herself as receptive to the visitation of those ideas as any writer that I've heard, and how despairing she felt if the idea came to her and she wasn't ready for it. I mean, it kind of what you described, and you didn't sound despairing about that. You sounded like, I'm just not at that place in my life. But she thought, what if that was the thing I was really meant to write about, and yet for whatever reason, I wasn't ready for that?
I know that feeling. I also know that that feeling does not generate work. And all I want to do is generate work. All I want to do with my very short life is to remain in contract and in exploration with creativity. And I know from lived experience that when I fall into despair or dismay, or I think, oh God, just as she said, that was supposed to be the one, or I watch someone else bring forth an idea that I had been thinking about, and I think, oh, I lost that one because I wasn't fast enough, I wasn't on it. Yeah. Somebody else did it better, it's not meant for me. None of those things serve the work. And I feel like the great breakthrough that I've had in my creative life is that I feel like artists are often, not just, and I don't mean capital A artists, I mean anybody making anything, makers, let's say it more democratically, are often given only two modes of thinking for how they can imagine their creativity. And one is that they are the slave to forces beyond their control, right? That they are like in this, the groundswell of this big thing that's overtaking them, that's using them like a hand puppet, that's controlling them. And the other one is that they are in control. You know, as Nabokov said of his characters, all of my characters are galley slaves. Somebody asked him, do your characters ever take a life of their own? He's like, I would never let them have a life of mine. So there's these two ways. One is very passive and sort of hippie trippy, like I'm just a channel and this stuff comes through me and I'm helpless in its wake. And the other one is very macho and aggressive and like, I'm going to knock this thing out and I'm in charge of it. To me, those two models are false. It's a false choice because to me also, they both feel like they have a lot of like, just a lot of violence in them, a lot of passivity or a lot of aggression. And for me, the more interesting way to see it is I am neither the slave nor the master of creative inspiration. I'm its collaborator. You know, I'm its partner. And we're different species. The idea comes from somewhere. I'm a human. I bring my labor. It brings the weird inspiration. We're trying to make something together. It's a very interesting process. So for me, if I can remain curious and interested and what a strange collaboration that is, rather than fussing over who's in charge, it seems to just keep me more calm. And the more calm I am, the more work I'm able to produce, which is really what it's all about.
You know, I think there are artists who are just quite all right with that description that you gave of, you know, I'm just the channel. The creativity chose me. For whatever reason, I have been put on the earth to express these great ideas. I mean, it kind of comes back to that creative elitism. And there are artists, writers, painters, many people in the creative field that benefit from that, don't they?
Yeah, I think, and look, if that's working for them and they're making the work they want to be making and they also manage to do it while still being a fairly decent human being and nice to the people around them, great. you know, terrific. That's fabulous. You know, I think one thing that discounts is the enormous amount of work they're putting into themselves, mm-hmm. right? And the hours of boring, repetitive practice that they do. You know, they're discounting the human labor when they say that. They're discounting, you know, the weeks, months, years that they sit down and do stuff that's often just very dull in order to have those moments of inspiration where everything is flying and soaring. And I think when they tell that story that I'm just the vessel and it comes through me, what happens is that when a young or aspiring creator sits down to work and that doesn't happen, they think, well, I guess I'm not a creative person,
yeah.
right? Because I'm not having that experience. And that's why somebody said to me the other day, wait, I don't understand. Do you believe in hard work or do you believe in the mysteries and magic of inspiration? And I was like, yes. The answer is yes. I believe in them both. They're equally important. And I don't want to live, and I think it's fully possible to live in a world where you can inhabit both the pragmatic, rational, you know, reasonable effort of what it takes to be a human being doing hard labor, and the idea that every once in a while something happens where you know that that thing didn't come from you. But it's the combination of those two things. It's the intersection of inspiration and labor where everything gets really interesting to me.
You know, I think so much of what you're saying really fits with some of the new research on talent. You know, a lot of people thought you're born with talent and then it's really what you're going to make of that talent. And when you reach genius levels, athletes, right? Good example of that.
Right.
You are expressing something that, well, the next kid never could have done because they weren't born with it. And now what we seem to understand about this is it's the people who do with their that spark of talent that really become exceptional. And, you know, I think I remember talking with a guest about this who said, what you don't hear or what we choose to ignore about Tiger Woods' exceptional capabilities is the practice, 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 the obsession
right.
with exploring that talent. And in some ways, I think we could fit that into what you're describing today.
Completely. And you know, I love the word talent. You know, it was a Roman word. It's a Latin word, and it comes from the Roman army. And your talent is your salary, which is also an interesting word. But it's your payment. It's what you were essentially what you're given. And different people are given different salaries. We know this of the world too. It's sort of if you picture a kind of a little sack of silver coins on a scale, your talent is how much that scale is tipped in that particular direction in your life.
That's such a great image.
You know, but then what we have to also remember is it's something that you now have to do something with. What you do with those sack of silver coins is what's going to make the difference, right? You're going to spend them on prostitutes and drugs? Are you going to bury it in your backyard and never invest it because you're so terrified somebody will take it and then nothing ever comes of it? Are you going to use it to buy piano lessons? What are you going to do with that thing you were given? Because I do believe that all of us do have our internal scales tipped slightly in different directions. I will never know how much natural writing talent I have. I know that from a very early age, anything having to do with a language was a little bit easier for me a great deal easier for me than anything having to do with, say, mathematics or engineering or science.
Mm-hmm.
Now, if I had been determined to become an engineer, I feel certain that if I had decided I was going to work 100 hours a week to master that, I probably could have, but it would have been a lot more extra work for me because I didn't naturally lean in that direction. And so the efficient thing to do is to put your energies behind where the scale is already tipping. you know, if there's something that you're sort of even if it's not something you're sure you're good at, if it's something you're just interested in or curious about, that's a kind of tipping of the scale as well. And for me, the fascinating thing is, what are you going to do with what you have or may not have? That's where the big magic happens.
And that big magic that Elizabeth Gilbert is talking about is the title of her newest book. It's out in paperback this month, and we'll continue the rebroadcast of this conversation that I had with her recently right after news. Phil, what are you watching this hour?
Good morning, Carrie. The police chief in Charlotte, North Carolina, says officers gave 43-year-old Keith Scott multiple warnings to drop a handgun before fatally shooting him. Police Chief Kerr Putney says officers were searching for a suspect yesterday when they saw Scott, a 43-year-old black man, exit a vehicle with a handgun. The officer who shot Scott is also black. Witnesses dispute the police account, but the chief says 16 officers sustained minor injuries during protests over the shooting last night, and one person was arrested. An airstrike in northern Syria killed 5 medics responding to an earlier bombing raid. That's according to a relief group working in the Aleppo area. The medical team had just arrived after an airstrike when planes circled around and struck again. Syrian government forces have been accused of carrying out so-called double-tap attacks throughout the 5.5-year war, placing paramedics and rescue workers in peril. Airbus says the U.S. government has granted it a license to sell the first 17 airplanes involved in a landmark deal with Iran, made possible by last year's nuclear agreement. The announcement comes as Iranian leaders and U.S. officials are gathered this week in New York for the U.N. General Assembly. Airbus received the license from the U.S. Treasury's Office of Foreign Assets Control. The first 17 planes will be A320s and A330s. Police say all schools on the small Canadian province of Prince Edward Island have been evacuated because of a potential threat. The Royal Canadian Mounted Police say students were taken to safe locations. Police provided no other details but say a news conference will be held later in the day. More news ahead on NPR News. The time now is 10:26.
Hi, I'm Chris Farrell. Join me for the next Conversations on the Creative Economy on October 14th with Joanne Jenkins, CEO of AARP. We'll discuss the mission and the business of ARP. Get your tickets now by going to nprnews.org/creativeeconomy.
I'm Tom Weber. Next hour on NPR News, learn about the world's largest refugee camp, Dadaab, near the Kenya-Somalia border. It was opened 25 years ago to be a temporary camp, but it's still open, and many Minnesota-Somali immigrants live there. Join us at 11.
Programming is supported by Shakopee Mdewakanton Sioux Community, which donates millions of dollars each year to provide scholarships, protect the environment, and improve health and safety in Minnesota communities. Learn more at ShakopeeDakota.org.
I'm Carrie Miller, and this hour we're listening back to my conversation with Elizabeth Gilbert. She's the author of Eat, Pray, Love, The Signature of All Things, and a lot of other books. And her latest is all about creativity and the courage that it takes to embrace the risks that creativity demands. It's called Big Magic, comes out in paperback next week. I asked our listeners during this show about moments where they had struggled with being creative. We got a good call from a listener in Texas.
At the beginning of the conversation, you guys were discussing how in school we tend to separate kids who we deem or recognize as creative from kids who are, you know, more straight thinking. Mm-hmm. And one of the things that I remember growing up in going through this process of this separation was that it wasn't that we were told we weren't creative. It's just that the word creative was replaced by the word artistic. And so it wasn't that we were being told you're not creative. It's that we were being told you're not artistic. And creativity in its nature takes a lot of forms, and I'm finding out as an adult now that I'm not an artistic person in that I can't paint or that I don't find an interest in those sorts of arts, but in what I'm doing, I have a lot of ability to creative problem solve, and that's taken me a long way in my very short career, but I've never thought of myself as a creative person, simply because it had the word artistic attached to it.
That's such a good point. Sorry, Jack, I didn't mean to interrupt you. I just got excited by what you said.
What else would you say about his thinking on that?
You know, first of all, congratulations to the school that you went to, Jack, that they didn't shame you in some way, because my dear friend Brené Brown, who's done a lot of work on vulnerability and courage and resilience, and who has determined that creativity and the use of creativity is one of the most important things to having a wholehearted and satisfied life, she talks about what she calls art scars, which is, you know, things that often happen in school where you know, there was a certain thing that you loved doing, and then somewhere along the way you got the message that you weren't good at it and you never did it again, and some very important part of yourself never had the opportunity to express itself. It sounds as though that didn't happen in Jack's school, and that when he saw the artistic kids sort of getting separated out, that felt right to him because he was putting his creativity in other ways. What I really like about what Jack said is that the idea of creativity being linked to artistry in a way that makes people say, I'm not a creative person. This is something that I take issue with as well, because creativity is a massive engine of power and innovation that lives within every human being. And I don't think that there are creative people and non-creative people. I think there are people who use their creativity and people who do not. You can use your creativity in lots of ways. Oftentimes there's a sentence you'll hear people say, it's almost a cliche, when they say, I don't have a creative bone in my body, right? And whenever I hear someone say that, I don't want to argue them. out of that, but I just make a suggestion to say, well, what if you were to exchange the word creative with the word curious? What happens to that sentence then, and how ludicrous does it begin to sound, right? Nobody would ever say, I don't have a curious bone in my body. Not interested in a single thing about life on Earth. You know, I mean, if you did say that, that would actually legitimately mean that you were probably for real in the grip of a terrible debilitating depression, because that would be one of the symptoms of a real depression, and you should probably be seeking some sort of help for that, because curiosity is the vitality that runs through you that says, I want to engage with this thing. I don't know, like, and whatever that thing is, whether it is a sort of social problem or an engineering problem or an artistic problem or an emotional thing, that you just want to use your vitality and your force to question it, to turn it upside down, to take it apart, to look at it from a different way. You know, so I feel like sometimes if we can even take the burden, the heavy burden of the word creativity off people and replace it with the much friendlier and more accessible word curiosity, then you can encourage people to have more curious lives, which will inevitably become more creative lives.
Liz Gilbert with us talking about her new book, Big Magic, Creative Living Beyond Fear. And let me grab a call here from Tina in Minneapolis. Hey, Tina.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I love the topic because we talk about fear and going down a path that you were kind of led to believe that you were supposed to go. I'm a child of immigrant parents, and, you know, we were supposed to come to the United States, go to school, take a rational job. When I took a role right in corporate America right out of college, and I was in IT, and up until recently I decided, you know, irrationally give up my six-figure income to start a cookie company and go down the path of culinary arts. And my husband was distraught at the whole idea of putting down that kind of money to explore my creative side. But I, like you were saying, the physical labor involved in this kind of, I guess, quote-unquote art is something that I didn't really think about. I probably put in more hours than I ever did as an IT person, but I come home and not feeling horrible about what I'm doing with my life. And it's very scary at first, but I think a lot of my friends now are living vicariously through me.
Well, Tina, don't put art in quotes, because great cookies, we all
right.
know that's art.
And oh, yeah.
What's the name of your business?
It's T-Rex Cookie Company. And,
good name, Tina.
My last name is Rexing, so it's Tina Rexing. And I make half-pound cookies. And
oh, wow. I need to know you, Tina.
So talk about irrational. A lot of people are like, no one would ever buy a half-pound cookie. Why would anyone want to do that?
I'll have one right now, please.
I'll run it over to the studio. I think as far as fear goes, I really love hearing about your thoughts on what can people do to kind of just put that fear aside and kind of jump in feet first.
Good.
First of all, brava. I love hearing what you're doing. It's fantastic. And one thing that really struck me about what you said, Tina, is that you come home having worked harder, but you're less tired. You know, that's a very good sign that you're doing what you're supposed to be doing with yourself. You know, I always feel like even a very bad day of writing is still the best gig in town. Like, I would still rather have a terrible day of writing than any other kind of work. So you're on the right path, obviously, and you took a very brave path. You know, here's the thing about creativity and fear. What you have to come to expect is that if you want to live any kind of a creative life at all, and my definition of a creative life is very simple, it's any life where you make your decisions based more on curiosity than on fear, routinely, again and again and again, you're going to expect to have to deal with your fear in a very real way, because creativity demands of us that we enter into realms with uncertain outcome. And our fear, by definition and by its job description, hates a realm with an uncertain outcome. Our fear is evolutionarily trained to believe that whenever you enter into a realm with uncertain outcome, the outcome is going to be your death. Which is why when you sit down to write a poem, you get so afraid. It's so irrational, but you get so afraid. Like, it's not going to kill you, but your fear thinks it is, because it doesn't know what you're doing. You know. And so for me, the way that I've managed it is not to try to deny the fear, not to try to punch it in the face, not to try to kick its butt. Like, there's all this very aggressive kind of extreme sports language going on around fear, like, kill your fear, show your fear who's boss. That doesn't work for me because fear is an essential part of my nature as a human being. And to try to kill it only seems to make it stronger. You know, the more I fight it, the more it fights back. So for me, it's just about constantly being in conversation with my fear and beginning a very respectful conversation with it and just saying, whenever it rises, I just speak to it and I just say, thank you so much. I know you're trying to protect me, but I don't need your services right now. I'm just writing an essay.
You're so rational. Is it really like that?
Do you know, it's what it is. It's not actually, it's totally irrational because if you were in my studio, you would hear me speaking aloud to fear as though it were a human being. So it's the opposite of rational. What it is compassionate. You know, it's compassionate to myself to say, I totally understand this aspect of you getting fired up right now. And I know that it's scary, but we're going to do this anyway. And it's okay. You know, it might work, it might not work. But whenever I weigh out the fear, whenever I begin a creative project, and I think this is really terrifying, I don't know if I can do it, which is how I begin every creative project because I've never done that thing before, you know, and I never know if I can do it. And the fear rises up. I just say, you know, I know you don't want me to do this, fear. But if you shut this down, my life becomes very small. And the walls of my life start to very much cramp in on me. And hey, in like 50 years, I'm going to be dead anyway. So
So why not?
Let's just do it. And if it doesn't work, then it didn't work. But at least I'll know that I made an effort to have a bigger, more expanded, more interesting life, just as Tina is doing with her bigger, more expanded cookies.
And guess what, Liz? You'll be happy to know that she's getting a lot of love on Twitter for her T-Rex cookies. I know.
Nice.
People are tweeting in to say how much they love them.
That's wonderful.
Okay, so this is a rather lengthy story about the triangle between the idea you and Ann Patchett. Can you tell it in a way that we can grasp it in a couple minutes?
Sure, I will. So I had an idea for a novel, and I won't go into the background of it other than to say that the idea was specifically this. It was about a middle-aged spinster from Minnesota who works for a large company who has been quietly and hopelessly in love with her married boss for years. And who has a very silent, sort of subtle, quiet, invisible life. Her boss gets involved in an ill-fated business deal down in the Amazon jungle. A bunch of money and a person goes missing, and she is sent down by her boss to recover the money and the person, at which point her quiet life is overthrown into chaos and drama and becoming, right? So for reasons that I won't get into now, I had to set that book aside. I actually got a book deal for it. I had started working on it. And then a bunch of stuff happened in my personal life and I couldn't attend to it. And several years passed before I picked it up again. When I picked it up again, I felt that the idea had abandoned me. It's a strange feeling, but I knew that that book was no longer going to be mine, that the animating force behind it was gone. Around that same time, I made friends with the wonderful, fantastic novelist Ann Patchett. She and I had this very electrifying first meeting. We actually gave each other a big kiss and told each other how much we loved each other's work, and we sort of fell in love as friends. We became pen pals, and she let me know a couple months later she was working on a book, and her book was about the Amazon jungle. We met in person and I asked her what her book was about. And she said, well, first you tell me what yours was about, because I mentioned I had also been doing an Amazon jungle book. So I told her my idea and she said, you've got to be effing kidding me. And I said, why? What's yours about? And she said, it's about a middle-aged spinster from Minnesota who works for a big company who's been helplessly in love with her married boss for years, and he gets involved in an ill-fated business deal in the Amazon, and a person and a bunch of money go missing, and she gets sent down to sort it out, at which point her quiet life gets turned into chaos, which I do not have to point out to you is not a genre. That is not a thing people write about. Yeah. That is an incredibly specific story, and we kind of counted back on our fingers to try to figure out when I had lost the idea and when she had found it, and it happened around the time we met. So in our magical thinking, and Anne, by the way, is a much more rational human being than I am. In our magical thinking, we decided that idea jumped from me to her in the moment of our meeting at the kiss, knowing the idea had a sense. There's actually a novelist in the room who actually
who
will do this book.
Yeah.
Like, because I do feel like inspiration, like lightning, seeks the most efficient, fastest conduit to earth. It will go through whoever is the most ready to make it happen. And I think that idea was like, Gilbert's not doing this. This is going to be an Ann Patchett novel. And of course, that novel became Ann's gorgeous book, State of Wonder.
Oh, boy. One of my favorites.
Oh, so it's magnificent. Good. And only Anne could have written exactly that book. And that's the other beautiful thing about it, about The Mysteries of Inspiration. We had exactly the same plot. They would have been two entirely different books. But crazily similar in the basic structure.
Well, so Ann Patchett toured, of course, for State of Wonder. And you reading that anecdote in your book made me go back and listen to the interview where we talked about how the idea developed for her. So I want you to hear just a tiny bit that conversation. Let's listen.
When I have been in these different colleges, and at the end of the program, they always ask me to help them find the book for next year. And one of the things I have been asked for again and again is, do you know a novel by a contemporary female author in which there are strong women role models, and it is not a book about falling in love or being victimized in some way by a man? And I haven't been able to think of that book.
My mind's a blank.
It's crazy, isn't it? And so that was really part of the original impetus. I thought there really should be a book about strong women, and it's not about them falling in love.
I really love that agenda that met up with the idea. It might have always been meant for her.
Exactly. And then she and I always joke that then I went on to write The Signature of All Things, which is, of course, also by a strong,
absolutely,
a strong woman. So we have in the end, they did become sister books. And she wrote me a beautiful letter saying, it's amazing how the idea sort of circled to me, went through me, came back to you in a different form. And we both ended up writing a story about a woman who goes on an adventure that's not a romantic adventure. But I love the, I too sometimes I feel like I get a mandate. I think she felt like she had a mandate to write that kind of a book. And she delivered on that, and she took that story and twisted it into that kind of a book because she ethically and sort of, from a cultural standpoint, wanted to have that be her contribution.
Yeah, I use the word agenda in the best possible sense of that. And so glad she did. Steph off the NPR news page.
Yeah, hi. Bill is skeptical. He says, this all sounds too much like everyone's a winner. Everyone gets a ribbon. Mm-hmm. Come on. You know, some people aren't creative or curious, and that's fine. They play an important role, too.
Elizabeth?
Bill. My goodness. Well, I think we should put Bill in charge of determining who is creative and curious and who isn't.
Okay.
Because clearly he's got it all sorted out. I'm not willing to take that position, and I'll tell you why. Because the world has humbled me against making a statement as emphatic as that about some people are this and some people are that, period. Because I have been schooled by the world not to see that way, because there are people who I believed when I was younger were the most talented and brilliant, magnificent-minded people I had ever met, and those people ended up doing jack with their creativity. Absolutely nothing. And I sit here 25 years later looking at their lives thinking, you had the most promise of anybody I ever knew, and you did nothing with it whatsoever. And there were people who I dismissed arrogantly as being dull-minded, sort of brickmakers, somebody who you could expect nothing from, who ended up creating things that knocked me to my knees. So there is absolutely no way in the world I'm ever going to get on the bandwagon of this is for some people, it's not for other people. Some people are naturally talented, other people are not. These are the mysteries that none of us can know. I think the much more interesting way to look at the world is to see almost limitless potential. It certainly makes it more fascinating for me to have interaction with people when I look at them with the assumption that they have hidden jewels inside, and that if they could release them, it would be a very interesting moment, rather than the assumption that they do not, that I do, but you don't. just seems like a terrible way to interact with other human beings. And when you approach people with the assumption that they have hidden magnificence, you're going to find much more interesting interactions with your fellow man.
William in St. Paul says, I'm a scientist and inventor. I do believe that ideas can come to anyone, not just special people. But you have to learn to listen to yourself. Too many people discount the inspirations they have because they've been taught to respect the status quo. Claire says on Twitter, for me, being a writer means I have to be vulnerable and have both a thin and thick skin at times. Living emotionally is brave. And Steph, off the page.
David says, as a child, it became clear I had musical aptitude. I started piano lessons fairly early. Consequently, I got put into that creative kids category. And with that came a lot of pressure to perform and live up to the creative label that everyone had given me. This had a number of effects. And one was, by the time I graduated from college with a composition degree, I was completely burned out.
Wow. Elizabeth, I don't want to end the conversation here without asking you where you're living, because last time I saw you, which was, I think, 2 years ago, or maybe just last year, you were moving out of that great house that you wrote the signature of all things in.
Yeah, so, that house was done.
Wow. And so are you in the new place and settling in and making it your own?
I am, actually. Yeah. You know, it's so funny. One of the one of the many irrational ways in which I engage with life is that I seem to have to move around a lot. And I don't really know why, but I think some of it has to do with I can never seem to write two books in the same place. I feel like once I've written a book in a place, it's like I sucked all the energy out of that place and I have to go to a fresh place. And so, once I was done writing the signature of all things in that house, I had to sell that house. Fortunately, I have a husband who's even more itinerant than I am. And so he's happy to make those moves with me.
Elizabeth Gilbert there. And there is some news about that husband and that house. Elizabeth Gilbert has recently split up with her husband, sold the house. She has begun and been talking about a new relationship with a very close friend of hers, a Syrian writer named Rhea Elias. You can read about it, I'm sure, on a lot of blogs, because Elizabeth Gilbert has been doing some interviews about it. The book is called Big Magic, comes out on paperback on Tuesday, and I talked with her about it last fall.